So go ahead and turn to Genesis chapter 19. We're continuing in our series through the book of Genesis. Back in 2008, I was in a preaching class, my very first class on preaching in seminary, as I was working on my Master of Divinity. And the first sermon that I preached was actually on this text. And I went and I looked for the video because it was recorded back then on a tape. So I looked for it. I could not find it. I was hoping to show a little clip of it. But, you know, honestly, it's probably good you don't see me from back in 2006 because it wasn't good at all. But I got a kick out of it. You will be happy to know, though, that this is a brand new sermon, so I didn't just reuse my sermon from 2006. So today's sermon is titled, The Perfect Storm of Sin. And Google defines the term, the perfect storm, as a disastrous situation created by a rare combination of multiple negative factors occurring simultaneously, essentially amplifying the severity of the problem and leading to a significantly worse outcome than any single factor alone. And if you're like, oh, what? Here's the short version. It's where multiple storms come together and create something worse. How's that? That's the Kyle definition there. And in 2000, there is a movie that came out that was with the same name, The Perfect Storm, and it was based on a ship out of Massachusetts that was lost at sea in 1991 due to what they call a perfect storm. And it's inspired by true events along with this massive storm that took place off the coast of the United States and eastern Canada that started out as a cyclone. And then the cyclone observed a hurricane from the south, and it turned into a powerful, destructive storm that caused $200 million in damage, and that's 20 years ago money, and then also sunk the sword fishing boat, the Andrea Gale, which is what the movie is about. This, by the way, is from the movie, not from real life, in case you're wondering. And in our passage today, we're going to see another perfect storm. And this perfect storm is what I call the perfect storm of sin. Because what we're going to see is two daughters committing incest with their father. And this is going to lead to a very big question of what in the world led to this point. And by the way, those that are here, it's not going to get graphic at all. That's, in fact, the word incest is the most graphic that we're going to get. And so we're going to see, though, that it wasn't just a random decision where some daughters decided to sleep with their drunk dad. And instead, it's going to be a series of events that combine together to lead to what I call the perfect storm of sin. Now, to remind us what happened back in chapter 18, we saw that Sodom and Gomorrah were judged for their sinfulness. And the angels drag Lot and his family out of Sodom, and Lot asks to go to Zoar. However, once it goes up in flames, Lot's wife turns back and is killed. And so, let's go ahead now that that's the history leading up to verse 30, let's go ahead and work our way through the passage. This one's a pretty short, pretty self-explanatory passage, and I'm going to read starting in verse 30. Now Lot went up out of Zoar and lived in the hills with his two daughters, for he was afraid to live in Zoar. And so he lived in a cave with his two daughters. And the firstborn said to the younger, our father is old, and there is not a man on earth to come in to us after the manner of all the earth. By the way, was there no more men left on earth? No. I wasn't there at the time, but I can assure you there were lots of men around at that time. Verse 32, come, let us make our father drink wine. Let me stop there. Can you force someone to drink wine? I mean, I suppose you could, theoretically, but let's be real. Was he forced to drink the wine? No. He may have been, they may have been like, hey, take some wine. And he's like, oh, yeah, I'll take some wine. So I don't know exactly what happened, but it's not like they made him drink it. And we will lie with him that we may preserve offspring from our father. And so they made their father drink wine that night. And the firstborn went in and lay with her father and did not know when she lay down or when she arose. And the next day, the firstborn said to the younger, behold, I lay last night with my father, and let us make him drink wine tonight also. Then you go in and lie with him, that we may preserve offspring from our father. And so they made their father drink wine that night also, and the younger arose and lay with him, and he did not know when she lay down or when she arose. Thus, both the daughters of Lot became pregnant by their father. And the firstborn bore a son and called his name Moab, and he is the father of the Moabites to this day. And the younger also bore a son and called his name Ben-Ammi, and he is the father of the Ammonites to this day. That's the end of the passage. So as I said, this passage is pretty self-explanatory in terms of what happened. But as I've already said, I think what we need to focus on is what led to these events. Why did this happen? And I want to propose to you that this is not just a one thing. This isn't just one thing that led to the sin. Instead, it was a lot of bad decisions and a lot of different sins that led to the perfect storm of sin. And so I'm going to go through the five of them. They're on your teaching sheet if you want to follow along. That's in the bulletin. But here's the first one, that Lot chose to be a friend to sin. And if I were to put it another way, Lot chose to be in and near sinfulness. So this started long before chapter 19. Back in chapter 13, Abraham and Lot need to separate to make room for their growing flocks. And so Abraham tells Lot to pick the direction that he wants to go. In verse 10, this is chapter 13, and Lot lifted up his eyes and saw the Jordan Valley was well watered everywhere, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt in the direction of Zoar. And this was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. And so Lot chose for himself all the Jordan Valley, and Lot journeyed east. Thus they separated from each other. And Abraham settled in the land of Canaan, while Lot settled among the cities of the valley and moved his tent as far as Sodom. Now the men of Sodom, wicked, great sinners against the Lord. And so that's chapter 13. Lot sees the nice-looking area. He sees it's also near Sodom, the city that we just read about. And he says, oh, I'm going to go in that direction. I'm going to go towards the direction of the sinful, wicked people. So he does this knowing that Sodom is a wicked place. But then in the very next chapter, in chapter 14, we learn that he's no longer near Sodom, he's now in Sodom. And we read in chapter 14, verse 12, about the kings who attacked Sodom. In verse 12, it says, and they also took Lot, so this is when the kings were fighting with Sodom and those surrounding areas, and they took Abram's brother, who was dwelling, what does it say, near Sodom? In Sodom! What happened here? What happened? Well, he got close to it and must have liked it and got closer, and then he eventually moved in. And Lot is not mentioned again until chapter 19, when the two angels that we read about last week go into the city of Sodom. And so now, chapter 19 is about 20 years after chapter 13. So Lot likely left a single man, a younger man. And now in chapter 19, he's married. He has grown children. And where is he living? He's living right in Sodom. And so seeing the two men that we saw last week, the two men go into the town square, he knew that those two men were in danger. Why? Because he knew of the sinfulness of the town. And so what I'm getting at here is that Lot intentionally chose to be near sinful Sodom. And then after that, he intentionally chose to be in sinful Sodom. And then after that, he intentionally chose to be part of sinful Sodom, as we'll see about his daughters getting engaged to men in Sodom. And so this contributed, this was the first part of what is the perfect storm of sin. And so therefore, I want to remind us that we need to be very careful about who or what we let influence us. And so I'm not saying that we should all live as monks and never be near people who think differently or even who are sinful. But what I'm saying is that what you choose to keep close to you will influence you over time. Young folks, have you ever looked at the, we'll just say some elderly folks who are married, who've been married for like 50, 60 years? Do they usually seem to sort of dress similar? Have you noticed that, or am I the only one? Do they act similar? You know, they're two different people, but do they have a lot of similarities after living together for 40, 50, 60 years? They influence each other. I read about a guy named Jack. Jack grew up in a small Christian community, close-knit community, and his parents were Christian. He grew up in the church. He was involved in his youth group. He was a leader in his youth group. And after graduating from high school, Jack went off to a big college. And he joined a group of friends who liked to stay up late and drink and party. And at first, Jack just wanted to hang out with them. He wanted to have friends. And so he hung out with them, but he didn't participate with the drinking. He didn't party with them. He just sort of hung out with them. But as the weeks went by, his friends started teasing him for not joining in. And they're like, oh, you're boring. Or you need to loosen up. And so one night, Jack wanted to prove to his pals that he wasn't uptight. And so he decided that he would have just one drink. And over time, that one drink led to regular participation with his pals. And this led to eventually to him staying up all parts of the night, being too tired to go to class, skipping class, and his grades slipped until he eventually lost his scholarship. Now, at what point did Jack go wrong? I would say that it wasn't when he took the first drink. It was even before that, when he decided that he was going to spend regular time, all his time, with friends that were going to influence him in a bad way. That's where he went wrong. But it's not just about people, though that is a big part. And so there's people, but really anything that you choose to spend your a lot of time with can influence you. And so the music that you listen to can either positively or negatively impact you and influence you. What you watch on television or on streaming can influence you. What you devour and consume on the internet can influence you. And so all these things that you put your time and effort into, these can all have an influence on you. And you've got to be careful. Because if you hang around and hang around and hang around the sinful TV shows and sinful books and sinful audio and then sinful friends, guess where your life is going to be headed? Guess what direction your thoughts are going to be headed? And then your actions. This leads to the next part of the perfect storm. And that is that Lot, I'll just put in probably, Lot probably married an unbelieving spouse. So I'll admit that this is speculation on my part, but Lot moved into sinful Sodom. He then makes his next appearance 20 years later, and he then has a wife and adult daughters. And earlier in chapter 19, we saw what happened to Lot and to his wife in particular. And so Sodom was being judged. The angels drag out Lot and his family, wife as well. And then what happens to Lot's wife? Well, she turns around. She turns back and ends up dying because of it. As one pastor put it, her heart was in Sodom, though her body was outside. Her eye turned to the place where her treasure was. Why? Well, the most reasonable answer is that Sodom was her hometown. She most likely had friends there. That was where her country club was. That was where she grew up. That was where her school and college were, so to speak. That was where everything was. And so as she was being pulled out of it, her heart was in Sodom, and she turned back around to go back towards it and ended up being killed in the flames. And if Lot's wife was from Sodom, then most likely she was not a believing spouse. But even more, Sodom was a horribly wicked place. And so it wasn't that she was just an unbeliever. She was from a pagan, sinful, full-on pagan practicing town. And I know this is a lot of guessing. It's a lot of speculation. But I don't think it's speculation to say that if Lot's wife had been a believing spouse, if she believed in God, she would have continued to follow the angels out of town and head away from Sodom and not towards it, and would have saved her life. And the reason why this is important is because it likely contributed, I wouldn't say likely, it contributed to the actions of Lot. Both in at the end of chapter 19, as we saw, as he was feeling lonely and ended up sleeping with his daughters and getting drunk and all this. But even before that point, it likely impacted him. It influenced him. No doubt an unbelieving spouse influenced his daughters. So this might be one reason why he chose to stay in Sodom for all those years. But even if she wasn't definitely a unbelieving person, her actions had a negative impact on her children. And so I just want to encourage those that are here that are not married. And I want to challenge you to be very, very careful about who you marry. And by way of that, to then also be very, very careful about who you date. If you're dating someone, you're looking at them with the possibility of marriage. And so you must be careful about who you choose to date and end up marrying. Because that is one of the biggest decisions of your life that will influence the spiritual direction of your house. And so be very, very careful about who you end up with as a partner for life. This leads to the third part of the perfect storm, and that is that not only was Lot influenced by the negative parts of Sodom, but Lot allowed his daughters to be exposed to and influenced by the sinfulness of Sodom. Now, how do I know this? Well, just look at their actions in the passage that we read. They grew up in a wicked, sinful city that, by the way, got judged as they were wanting to try to take advantage of these two angels. And when things got difficult and rough, they turned to wicked, sinful actions to, quote unquote, fix their problems. So just like Lot was influenced by Sodom, and just like his wife was likely influenced by Sodom, so also his children were influenced by Sodom. And parents that are here, I want to remind you, of what God calls each of us as parents to do. In Ephesians 6:4, fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but what are we told to do? Bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Old Testament and Proverbs, train up a child in the way he should go, and even when he's old, he will not depart from it. Or Deuteronomy 6, and these words that I command to you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit down, and when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise. So why is God telling his followers to do this? Well, it's because God knows that someone is going to influence your children. And as Christian parents, we are called to be the ones to influence them in a positive way, to train them and to disciple them and to point them towards Jesus Christ. Now, ultimately, it's up to the child to decide what they're going to do. But far too often, parents, we fail at doing that. There was a dad who was driving with his son in the back seat. Police officer pulled him over for speeding, and the officer came up to the window, and the dad went into this big explanation about why he was speeding, and he made it all up. It was a big lie about what happened. And the officer bought into it and let him off with a warning. And after the officer left, the dad leaned back and proudly told his son, said, "See, son, it's all about knowing how to talk your way out of things." So guess what his son did? Well, later that week, the son's teacher called home to report that the boy had been caught lying about not doing his homework. And when confronted by his teachers, the boy told them, he said, "Don't worry, I was just trying to talk my way out of it, just like my dad taught me." And whether or not that's a true story, the sad fact is that parents, directly or indirectly, often negatively influence their children. And I think we would all agree, as parents, we're far from perfect. But may we do all that we can to point our kids towards Jesus Christ. And by the way, parents, that starts with modeling it to them. Showing them that this is how you love Jesus Christ. Imperfectly, yes. Struggling at times, yes. Messing up at times, yes. But there's a big difference between trying to model a relationship of following after Jesus Christ and just going the opposite direction and modeling hypocrisy and modeling not following after Jesus Christ. Fourth way, fourth part of the perfect storm of sin, that is that Lot chose to isolate himself instead of turn to his godly family. So in chapter 19, the angels drag Lot out of the town of Sodom. In verse 17, as they brought them out, he said, "Escape for your life," this is the angel, "do not look back or stop anywhere in the valley. Escape to the hills, lest you be swept away." Now, what hills was he referring to? We don't know for certain, but most likely the hills that the angels are talking about are the hills that are in the direction of where he came from originally, towards Abraham. Because Abraham was up in those hills. Because at one point, when Abraham was talking to God, looking out over the valley where Sodom was. So Abraham was up in the hills. And Lot says, he's afraid to go to the hills. It's scary up there. And he has to go to the nearby town of Zoar instead. But what was he afraid of? What was he afraid of? This is just my theory. But it wasn't that he was afraid of hills and wild animals or whatever it may be. He was afraid of going back home to see his uncle, right? Uncle? To see his uncle Abraham. He's afraid to see him. He was afraid because he had identified with Sodom and he had turned and rejected the God of Abraham in some way. So my theory is that he didn't want to go back to his family. But then we get to the passage, our main passage today. And what does it say? Lot went up out of Zoar and lived in the hills with his two daughters, for he was afraid to live in Zoar. So he lived in a cave with his two daughters. And so no explanation is given here. But most likely, he was afraid to show his face in Zoar as well, as one of the only surviving people of Sodom. And so instead, he turned to the mountains, but not to the mountains in the direction of Abraham, but to the mountains in the direction of Zoar and past that. So here he is, away from his family, away from his extended family, living in isolation. What could go wrong, right? Well, as we see, quite a bit. And this is an important lesson that we all remember by way of application, that an isolated Christian is an at-risk Christian. So whether you are an extrovert or an introvert, God designed us to live in community. Don't worry, for you introverts, that can include times of being alone. But there's a difference between having alone time and living isolated and living completely alone. So when you live isolated from other believers, Satan knows that you are at risk of giving in to temptation. So it's no wonder that so many of the addictions that people struggle with and can't seem to get rid of are ones that thrive in isolation. It's no wonder that so many times the Christian leaders that end up in the news for the bad reasons are the ones that isolated themselves. You go back and you read their stories, and almost always they said, I didn't listen to my friends. I moved away. I was too good for them. As I grew in popularity, I thought I was indestructible. You know, all these things, they isolated themselves. So do you think that Lot would have committed incest if he was living near Abraham? I would say most likely not. Now, thankfully, if you are here today, there is an easy solution to isolation. You see, being part of a church community is one of the big ways that you can avoid isolation. But it needs to go beyond just showing up for a Sunday service, which, by the way, is really good, and I hope you keep doing that. But this is why the next part of church, the small groups, are so important. Small groups are a way for you to get to know others in the church better than you can here on Sunday morning. Now, it takes time and effort, and you know, some people make friends better than others, but if you will invest the energy to do this, you will eventually reap rewards. Because living in community allows you to rub shoulders with fellow Christians. And these fellow Christians will encourage you. And hopefully you will, over time, encourage them as well. At times, these fellow Christians may challenge you or even correct you. But in the end, living in community with fellow believers will make you stronger spiritually. Ecclesiastes 4:12. And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. And right now, here at church, we have 10 different small groups that we offer. We have 3 men's groups, 2 women's groups, 2 Sunday school classes. We have what's called a D-Life group. We have 1 prayer group, and we have a grief share group. And a summary of the groups can be found if you go to the bulletin. There's a link there at the very bottom of the, in the middle. Or you can go to our website and on the homepage. It's a description of those groups. And as the church council met, the deacons and pastors met earlier this week, and our goal is to increase the number of small groups by 50% this year. And that's because there is power in community. And so if you're interested in learning more about groups or want to join one, you can just contact the office or you can grab one of the connection cards and just fill it out in the back. There's a way of letting us know that you want to join a group. And this leads to the last part of the of what led to the perfect storm of sin. That is that Lot dulled the pain with alcohol. Now, I think we would all agree that Lot and his daughters had just gone through a very traumatic experience where they were ripped out of their homes. The daughters lost their fiancés. They lost their mother. Lot lost his wife. The entire town is destroyed before their very eyes. They're now living in isolation. So clearly, they are suffering. And Lot, in an effort to dull the pain, likely then turns to alcohol. Now, technically, as I said, it says that his daughters, quote, made him drink. But as I said, no one really makes you drink alcohol to get to the point of blackout drunk. He wanted to. He likely was doing it over time. Now, in previous sermons, I've talked about alcohol and the dangers of alcohol. And as a Cliff Notes version here, I've said before that alcohol in and of itself is not a sin. After all, Jesus' first miracle was making alcohol. But I've also said a number of times that given the high potential for addiction, it would be very, very unwise for many people to go near alcohol, even if you're not getting drunk. It's just it can be very addictive. So you must be very, you have to handle it carefully, if at all. Now, having said all that, the Bible does make it very clear that getting drunk is a sin, and Lot's story here is one reason why this is a bad thing to do. I'm not saying that if you get drunk, you're going to commit incest, but you are setting yourself up for problems. Because not only does excess drinking lead to health problems, by the way, someone who used to work in the hospital, I can tell you that bad things happen to people who drink a lot. But by the way, it also then leads to you losing control of yourself. And to do things that you will regret. And God wants every Christian to be alert and ready for the attacks of Satan. Because guess what? Satan's not getting drunk. He is out looking for people to devour. That's why Peter says, be sober-minded. Be watchful. Because your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. Can you do that when you're drunk? And in Lot's case, he was devoured by Satan in that situation. Now, sadly, the story here at the end of chapter 19, this is the last time that we see Lot in action. He's mentioned again in the Old and New Testament, but they're only for actions that have already taken place. And so it's safe to say that Lot sinned himself right into ineffectiveness and obscurity. I want to ask you, what about you? Would you describe yourself as friend to sin? Where are you giving in to sin, and where are you giving in to the ways of the world? And so I want to encourage you to be sober-minded and to be watchful. So as we wrap up, I'm just going to quickly talk about where is Christ in this passage, as we do every time in this series. And it's sort of strange to ask this question in this story. to ask it in the context of two daughters committing incest with their father, where is Christ in this passage? That's a little bit weird. And it seems like they should not be together. But listen, this is the beauty of the gospel, the good news of Jesus. That God comes to us, not when we're good and deserving, but when we're sinful. And in verses 36 and 37, we get an idea of where Christ is in this passage. Let me read this again. Thus, both of the daughters of Lot became pregnant by their father. The firstborn bore a son and called his name Moab, and he is the father of the Moabites to this day. And so the Moabites, this group of people, would cause all sorts of problems for Israel over the years. But as time went on, there would be a Moabite woman named Ruth. And Ruth would eventually move to Israel with her mother-in-law after her husband died. Ruth would marry Boaz from Israel. Fast forward some more generations and we get to King David. And then fast forward some more generations and we get to Jesus Christ. And so Jesus Christ, the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, came from a family line of incest. And in doing so, it was like he was saying, no matter your sin, I've got this. No matter how bad you've been, I can take care of it. No matter how much you've messed up, I can redeem your situation. No matter how horrible life has been to you, I can be your Savior. And so I want to ask you, will you turn to him and will you give him your life? Will you seek to get that sin out of your life? Let me close with this story. Last week I read a book about the Titanic. Most of you are familiar with the story, the ship in 1912 that hit an iceberg and sank, even though it was considered by many unsinkable. And as I read the story, though, I was struck, no pun intended, with how people reacted to hitting an iceberg. So after it struck the iceberg, the captain, shortly after, knew the ship was going to sink. And so he asked his staff to go and direct people to the lifeboats, but he told them to do it in a way that would not cause a scare, that would not cause a panic. And so people were directed out to the lifeboat deck, and as they got the lifeboats ready, the people that were waiting got cold, and so they moved back inside where it was warm. And once the boats were ready, the staff tried to get them to go into the lifeboats, but the boats were there hanging over the edge, 80 feet above the water. It was bright and warm on the ship, and they couldn't even see down below in the darkness. They couldn't even see the water. And one passenger, a millionaire named John Jacob Astor, he said, "We're safer here than in that little boat." And so many people refused to get in that lifeboat. And so many people refused that between one-third and one-half of the boat, or the boats were between one-third and one-half full when they were lowered into the water. And so due to the lack of urgency, there were hundreds of open seats on the lifeboats as the lifeboats went off away from the sinking ship. And it was not until the lifeboats got further out that they could see the Titanic was indeed sinking, that it was in danger. But while the passengers couldn't see it, the people on the lifeboats could see it. And church, too often, we live like we're on that sinking ship where it's warm and comfy, and we don't want to get off into the unknown and into the what looks cold. And so we want to stay on. But if we stay on, it's going to take us down and down and down into sin. So staying in sin may feel comfortable. It will feel comfortable at times. But it will also, if you let it, lead you to the perfect storm of sin in your life. But the good news for all of us is that we have an amazing Savior. And we cannot save ourselves, but Christ can. And so may all of us turn to Him today. And may all of us give Him our lives. And for those of you here, that are struggling, you've turned to Him in the past, but you feel like you're caught up in that perfect storm of sin. I want to encourage you, turn to Him and ask Him for help to get you out of that. Turn to Christian community. Turn to your brothers or to your sisters that can encourage you and hold you accountable and help you through the process. We serve an amazing God, and Jesus Christ will save us if we ask Him, and He will give us freedom if we let Him. Let's go ahead and let's pray.